Yo, this is Douglas from Tagabout, and you're listening to WMUCFM College Park.
Hey, UMD students. Worried about possible sexually transmitted infections? Did you know that you can get tested for an STI completely free? The University Health Center is offering free STI testing events on the ground floor of the University Health Center. Go to www.helpumd.edu to search for upcoming dates. So go get tested and be a healthy Terp.
All right, welcome in. You are listening to WMUC-FM Radio here in College Park. My name is Jack Wynn. I am hosting the show Winning Time. It's your favorite sports talk show here in the DMV and on 90.5. Now, we've got an amazing show for you today. We had an unbelievable game in the NBA last night that we're going to dive deep into. We've got a lot of sports stories to talk about, but just quickly, I want to point out the fact that this is my last show. I've been hosting Winning Time here on WMUC for a few years now. I am so thankful for the opportunity to discuss sports with you, to share what I think are the beautiful stories, the underlying narratives, and all the things that make sports so incredible. And I appreciate you for tuning in and listening for all this time. But before we get into things, we do have to play a quick message for you here at the top of the show. And when we get back, we are talking all about Victor Wembanyama and the incredible performance that he had last night against the Thunder in taking that 1-0 series victory. With you on all of that after this.
Are you looking for a club that celebrates friendship? Then Best Buddies might be the one for you. We organize social events for local folks with disabilities to come to campus and hang out. Some of our highlights of the past years have been our holiday parties, a polar bear plunge in the freezing Chesapeake Bay, our friendship walk with Best Buddies branches from around the state, and a winter formal with over 80 people. And if you want to learn more information, check out our Instagram at BestBuddiesUMD.
All right, welcome back in. Best Buddies is a great club, great organization and program. Highly recommend supporting those involved if possible. Anyway, we've got a lot to talk about, so we are going to get right into it. We had one of the greatest games that I have ever seen in the NBA last night as the San Antonio Spurs took down the Thunder in double overtime in Game 1. Now, the Spurs were led by, of course, Victor Wembanyama. And when legendary players do legendary things, we have an obligation to appreciate it, to discuss it, to bask in all of its glory. And the performance we saw from Victor Wembanyama last night was absolutely legendary. He was dominant for the entire game. He was clutch, he was efficient, and he was just seemingly unstoppable on both sides of the court. 41 points, 24 rebounds, 9 of which were on the offensive end, not to mention 3 assists, 3 blocks, and a steal. He also hit the three-point shot from almost the logo to tie the game and take it to double overtime, which just took so much guts from Wemby in that spot. So we're going to zoom out for a second before we talk about just how remarkable Wemby was, because this game lived up to all the hype, but it had hype for a reason. So first off, the Spurs were very confident in themselves coming into the year, and it showed its head and why early on and midway through the season, because the Spurs were very good very quickly. They were one of the better defensive teams in the league. They were the best rebounding team in the league. Wemby was coming into his own and playing like a top five player. He was healthy. All of those things gave them reason to be confident. And then they had a bit of a mini series against the Oklahoma City Thunder. They had a few games in a couple of weeks. They had multiple games in a 3 or 4 day span. And the Spurs comfortably beat OKC most of the time. Not to mention Wemby wasn't even healthy for those games early on in the season. And so that gave the Spurs the utmost confidence to play well in this spot. For the Thunder, it showed them that they might have a rival for the first time, a team that can go toe-to-toe to them that's just as young, just as athletic, and just as talented. And for the first time in 2 years, it feels like the Thunder may have a real competitor. Now, the rivalry and stakes for this game only got higher right before tip-off, when it was announced that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander had officially won the league MVP award for this past season. And don't get me wrong, Shai deserved it. I thought he was clearly the MVP. He got 83 of the first place votes. So that tells you all you need to know about, you know, where he stands in the league right now. He averaged 30 plus points per game, one of the better defensive guards, 60 plus wins back-to-back seasons. Shai is the MVP. But they announced this right before the Western Conference Finals started. And Victor Wembanyama on the other side of the court was upset. And he made it very clear after the game that the MVP announcement absolutely impacted and inspired him. And so, Wemby dominating reminded me of two all-time performances. All the way back in 1997, or maybe it was 1998, Michael Jordan stood as Carl... Oh, no, no, no. It was 1995. And Hakeem Olajuwon watched as David Robinson won an MVP award that he thought he rightfully deserved. All of a sudden, they face off that night. He's dominant, takes over the game, and proves to the world why he felt like he was the best player. Almost 30 years later, Wemby does the exact same thing. LeBron James, in 2007... took a Cavs team that hadn't been to the conference finals in over a decade, brought them all the way back, took over a game against Detroit, who was the overwhelming conference favorites, and established himself as the best player in the world. It reminds me a lot of what we saw from Wemby last night. Taking over the game the way he did, being so dominant on both sides of the court for so long, I thought was a true testament to his greatness, and to just how historic of a performance this was. He was, a lot of the time with Wemby, we'll see some inconsistency. You know, it'll be not a lot of shots from the inside, he'll get too overly dependent from three, or the shots just won't fall, and he still tries to impact the game in other ways. Well, not last night. Everything was falling for him. He had not just a high volume shooting night, because he was 14 for 25. He was very efficient, 42 points, as I mentioned. But his buckets came in huge times. The three-pointer, as I mentioned, where he pulled up confidently from the logo, with plenty of time still left on the shot clock, by the way, to nail the three, send it to up double overtime. He's 7'5", and he's taking and making those kinds of shots. Then, in double overtime, towards the end, the back-to-back dunks, the and one, to essentially close out and ice the game while playing excellent defense. That shows Wemby coming through in a big spot. It is a reminder that he is going to be one of the best players in the world for a long time, and eventually is going to be one of the greatest players that this league has ever seen. And we need to appreciate it as it's coming, and we need to admire it. And it's kind of fascinating, because a lot of the time you hear about these all-time great NBA players and their legendary performances early on in their career. And for many people, you don't actually get to experience that. You know, I'm in my 20s. I never got to see early LeBron. I never got to see early Jordan or Kobe or Shaq or any of that. But I'm getting to see, we are all in real time seeing Wemby's career play out. We know he's going to be an all-time great. This is going to be one of those games and moments on his resume that we remember and point to. Just remember how dominant Wemby was in his first ever playoff run, in his first conference finals. Those are things we're going to be saying, and those are things that we're watching before our very eyes right now. So if you missed game one, highly recommend tuning in for game two. For the rest of the series, it's going to be a great one. For the rest of the Spurs, they were struggling. The rest of the team shot 27 for 71 from the field. Dylan Harper had 20 points, but didn't really have the impact that you were hoping to. Now, a lot of the Spurs role guys came in big spots. They played sound fundamental basketball like they have all year, but Wemby was really the engine that made everything go. From a defensive perspective, by the way, this is a fascinating matchup. Because for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who's the MVP of the league, who at the moment at least holds the title of best player in the world until Wemby officially takes it from him, Shai loves to play in the mid-range and at the rim. He likes twisting defenders, making them unsure of where he's going to go, and then picking in one of those two spots or getting to the line. Just, it's highly efficient basketball. Victor Wembanyama on the other side of the court messes things up, because Wemby, with his size, length, and talent, is uniquely qualified to guard this Thunder team. First of all, the way he matches up with their bigs. He's taller and quicker than Isaiah Hartenstein. He's essentially slightly better at everything than Chet Holmgren. So that gives the Spurs an advantage. But for Shai, Wemby can guard both the mid-range and the rim at the same time. And so if Shai is trying to work in that area, all of a sudden it becomes a lot more difficult. The time to close out when he's taking a layup is much shorter. He's got to get those shots up much quicker. Wemby's not going to be as drawn into fouling as maybe some of these other defenders were, because he doesn't have to be as physically close to alter or contest a shot. So this really hurt Shai for the start of the game, at least. And he was fairly inefficient for most of the game. Granted, he still got his, and he was still impactful. 24 points, 7 of 23 from the field, still had 12 assists, and 5 steals, by the way, to go along with a block. So this is something we say about great players frequently on this show. If your shot's not falling, make sure you impact the game in other ways. And for Shai to play 51 minutes, score 24 points after averaging 30-plus for 2 full seasons in a row, I think there's an element of concern for OKC about how the Spurs team is capable of guarding them. Now, Shai is still great. And in the end of the fourth quarter and in both overtimes, you were perfectly comfortable with the ball in his hands. Excuse me. But there was a clear disparity between him and Wemby. And Wemby was clearly playing like the better player. And so for Shai to now be down 0-1 at home with game 2 in 2 days, he needs to turn this around. And he's going to have to find ways to have good performances, because the Spurs aren't going to let up on defense. They're not going to change their strategy while it's working. Wemby's not getting any worse. And so for somebody who is arguably the best player in the world, at the very least a back-to-back league MVP, you would hope that they could find a way to still play their best game. Alex Caruso is the reason that OKC was able to keep going through it, even though Shai was struggling so much. What an unbelievable performance from him. 31 points, 8 made threes, by the way, which is just unbelievable for a role player. And 2 blocks, 2 steals as well to go with it. So Caruso was impactful in every possible way. They had him on the wing. They had him taking the ball up on offense. They had him setting on-ball and off-ball screens. He was flying open. It seemed like he was wide open in the corner every other play, and he just kept making those threes. It was huge, and it kept OKC in it, even though the Spurs kept trying to pull away. On defense, Caruso was guarding pretty much everybody, including Wembanyama, who was literally over a foot taller than the man. And he was doing a sound job, too. The Thunder's strategy for guarding Wemby, I thought, was interesting, because they kind of acknowledged nobody on their team is tall enough or strong enough to stop him. Let's just see if we can get as many guys on him as we can, or try a bunch of different things. Whoever can swipe the ball out of his hands the quickest and the most efficiently, that's what we'll try. And so that's what they had Caruso doing every now and then. But you're not going to get another performance like that from Alex Caruso this series, if I had to guess. You're going to need a lot of these other role guys to step up. A.J. Mitchell played 34 minutes, scored 4 points. He was one of the best players on OKC in the series against the Lakers just a week ago. Lou Dort, 5 points. Chet, 8 points. Just a really underwhelming output for OKC as a team, and it seems like they've got to figure out how they're going to adjust what the Spurs are doing, because they've got a great plan for them right now. Jalen Williams, very solid performance in his first game back, 26 points on good efficiency. You would think that having your second best guy back, there might be a little bit of rust. He might come in a little slow, but he was pretty hot off the start. And so as OKC gets healthier and regroups, we'll see if they're able to play like the team we expect them to, because the Spurs just really crushed them. I mean, they out-rebounded the Thunder 61-41. They killed them on the offensive glass, defensive glass, shot blocking, everything. And for a Thunder team that has been in talks about a dynasty, their all-time status, they're going to have to prove it very quickly. Because if you go down 0-2 at home, that is quite the mountain to climb. I do think that they're going to turn it around and win the series. I think they win game 2. Keep in mind, it did take a Wemby almost half-court shot to take this game to double overtime. The Thunder had it in their grasps plenty of times. So it's not like they were... This is not some one-sided series. I think the Thunder are still going to win in 7 games. I think they win game 2, probably win game 3 or 4 on the road, and then keep it back at home. That's what I expect. Send them back to the finals to go on and win their second straight ring. All right, moving on to the other side of the bracket. We had a game 7 play out, and unfortunately, it was not an exciting one. It was a blowout, as the Cavaliers crushed the Detroit Pistons. And I'll admit, I was wrong. I was very confident that the Pistons were going to win the series. I was very confident that the Pistons were going to win the series. And even when they were down 3-2, I was still comfortable enough in that roster and in Cade Cunningham that they would come back and turn it around. And instead, good for the Cavs. You know, this is a team that has been knocking on the door for a while. They have lost in the second round several years in a row, and now they get a chance in the conference finals that they haven't had since LeBron left the team. This is their first conference finals appearance since 2018. So, very exciting for the franchise as a whole. Now, for the game itself, the bigs were really the story of the game for Cleveland. They out-rebounded Detroit on the offensive and defensive glass. They forced Detroit to shoot 35% from the field as a team. Evan Mobley, 21 points, 12 rebounds, 6 assists, 4 combined steals and blocks. Jared Allen, 8 for 14 shooting, 23 points, 7 boards of his own. So, really strong performances. Pistons couldn't do anything with it. Jalen Duren looked like a cone out there, to be honest, defensively. For the Cavs guards, there's a little bit more substance there, because there's a little more to talk about. Donovan Mitchell wasn't afraid to come in and play. 26 points, took 22 shots, 6 rebounds, 8 assists. And I didn't expect him to be as good as he was in a Game 7. We've seen him struggle a lot. But this was an important moment for him. Mitchell hasn't been to a conference finals in years. And him finally getting his chance now to make a run at a ring, I think, is fun for the league. He's an exciting player. He's been trying to get over this hump for a long time. But for James Harden, this was almost a comical game, because I knew going in, the reason that I was so confident in Detroit was because I thought the ball was going to be in James Harden's hands a lot, and come big games, Game 6, Game 7, that would benefit the Pistons heavily. Well, Game 7 came around, and it felt like their game plan was to keep the ball out of Harden's hands. And it worked beautifully. Harden had only 9 points, 5 rebounds, and 6 assists, which is solid. But for the most part, he wasn't involved in the offense. He wasn't really controlling things. His usage rate wasn't that high. And the Cavs just kept on rolling. Everyone else seemed to get going, make shots. Sam Merrill had 23 points, 5 made threes. Dean Wade had a couple of big plays. Just a really well-rounded team performance for Cleveland. And James Harden being not involved, I thought, was helpful and a very good idea. I knew he would do nothing in that Game 7. He shot 2 of 10 from the field. Nothing else is new. And so good for Cleveland for recognizing that they have a player with that glaring of a weakness in big spots and for adjusting around it. Meanwhile, for Detroit, just an absolute disaster and an incredibly underwhelming season that now comes to a close for the Pistons. They had a very solid regular season, and they won 60-plus games. They were the one seed. They were very dominant all year. Cade Cunningham was looking like one of the best players in the world, averaged 24, 5, and 10. And the rest of the team was playing really well, too. And then the playoffs came around, and things just continued to unravel for them. First, they fall down 3-1 to the Magic, and have to scrape and claw their way all the way back into the second round. Then they fall down 3-2 to Cleveland, lose in Game 7. Just a brutal playoff run for Detroit, and it's clear that they're going to need to make some moves this offseason, because this roster is not built to win games and not built to win in the playoffs. They got out of the first round because Cade had a Herculean effort. He averaged, I think it was 35, 5, and 5. For those last 3 games, if I remember correctly. And you just couldn't get that from a player consistently. You can't ask someone to do that every round unless they're LeBron James. So Cade in Game 7 was terrible. 13 points, 5 of 16 from the field, 4 rebounds and 5 assists, 3 turnovers. The Pistons were outscored by 32 while Cade was on the floor. So not a great performance from him. They definitely could have used him. But this game just got out of hand really, really quickly. I mean, it was almost a 20-point deficit at halftime, and they were just never able to fight their way out of it. And the rest of the Pistons team was awful. They need to surround Cade with real talent. It is clear that this team has no real playmaking, no real size, no real offensive burst from their wing players, and those are all things that are essential to winning a ring. The fact that they got this far playing this style of basketball is almost impressive. But you have a superstar. Cade is a top 10 player in the league who is absolutely capable of playing like a top 5 guy at times, which we just saw these playoffs. And so if you're serious about winning a championship, you better go sign some real talent, make some big trades, and put the right pieces around him. Because what you have right now is just not working. Dennis Jenkins going 4 of 12 from the field, 2 of 7 from 3. Marcus Sasser shooting 3 of 12 from the field. Caris LeVert still playing serious minutes in the playoffs in the year 2026. I don't get this roster construction. I don't know what Detroit is trying to put together, I would recommend getting a real big who can play alongside Cade and maybe a couple shooting wings, because this offense is so stagnant right now. It is unbelievably Cade-dependent, and if they don't change something, they're just going to keep running in place. All right, so moving on then, we can look to the future. Knicks-Cavs in the Eastern Conference Finals. I think the Knicks are just going to walk them down, to be honest. I've got New York in five. What we have to remember is that the Knicks are kind of in people the back of people's minds right now because they've been resting for so long, but they have been in the midst of one of the greatest stretches in NBA playoff history. Their pace of play right now and the rate that they're winning is on par with Jordan's Bulls, Kareem's Bucks, and Magic's Lakers. So they're really just on another level. You would assume that the extra days of rest would help them because Cleveland is coming off of a battle of a seven-game series against Detroit, and the Knicks finished their series over a week ago. Not to mention, there's nobody in Cleveland that scares me from a defensive standpoint in the backcourt. Like, who's guarding Jalen Brunson? Who's guarding OG Anunoby? When Josh Hart is inevitably, you know, causing issues and fighting for boards and loose balls, who's going to be on the floor with him? Not Harden, not Mitchell, not a lot of these other, you know, small, scrappy role guys. The Cavs have an advantage in the paint because Mobley and Allen are really solid, and, you know, it's going to be a tough matchup for Cat and Mitchell Robinson, but I just think the Knicks are a better team. They're more well-rounded. They're more experienced, by the way. The Knicks have been in this spot before, and this Cleveland team has not. And I just believe in Brunson, honestly. He averaged 25-plus points per game against Cleveland this season. He's having a great playoff run. He's incredibly efficient. I just don't see this Knicks team falling apart, unless I'm just completely wrong about who this Cavs team is. I've got Knicks in five. All right, we're about halfway through the first hour of our last show here. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're swinging it over to the NFL. OTAs have started this week. We've got a lot to discuss with you after this.
Curb Stop Violence is a campus resource housed in UMD's University Health Center. The care office provides free, confidential advocacy and therapy services for survivors of sexual assault. Care to Stop Violence is a campus resource housed in UMD's University Health Center. The care office provides free, confidential advocacy and therapy services for survivors of sexual assault, relationship violence, stalking, and sexual harassment. Survivors and their supporters can make an appointment with a trained advocate or call our 24/7 hot crisis line to speak to someone right away. Additionally, we work to empower the campus community to prevent power-based violence through educational presentations, events, and outreach activities. Learn more about our available services and programs by visiting health.umd.edu/care.
When might you be buzzed? When you suddenly love everything.
You guys, I love this song.
I love these nachos.
I love our kickball league. Ugh! I love this guy.
What's your name?
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzzed warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I love your car. Is this real leather?
Campus Pantry is a free resource available for all UMD students, faculty, and staff experiencing food insecurity. It is open 5 days a week from 10 to 5 and is located on the ground floor of the South Campus Dining Building, next to the Common Shop. You must swipe your university ID before entering and check out before leaving. Make sure to bring your own reusable bag. For more information, you can visit the UMD Campus Pantry website at campuspantry.umd.edu. That's campuspantry.umd.edu. the University of Maryland Farmers.
Come all of you good workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Are you a graduate assistant, research assistant, or teaching assistant at UMD? Are you tired of low pay, long hours, high fees, and no safety net for international students? So are we. The UMD Graduate Labor Union is organizing for collective bargaining rights for graduate workers on campus.
Right now, the administration unilaterally controls our working conditions, but we are fighting to change that. To learn more about graduate labor organizing efforts on campus and what a union can do for you, visit umdgradworkers.org.
All right, welcome back in. I apologize if there are any, you know, issues with the audio here, but we're doing our best with it. So, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to WMUC FM radio here on 90.5 in College Park on FM. I'm Jack Wynn, hosting your favorite sports talk show, Winning Time. We just did a deep dive into the NBA. We talked about Wemby and the Spurs and their dominant win last night. And we talked about Cleveland moving on to take on the Knicks. But now we shift gears, we move to the NFL, and we are getting into OTAs. So, for those of you who are not familiar, the OTAs are the optional, you know, off-season workout programs that the players can attend. It's often for rookies. It's alongside minicamp. And, you know, it just gives a team their first opportunity to work with the players and the coaches and start to implement the schemes, the identity, the culture that they've been working on. So there are a lot of teams to look at early on. There are some teams that you don't. For example, we don't have to worry about Seattle. We know that their process is sound. We don't have to, you know, look at a team like Green Bay or Chicago. We know their process is sound. There's not a lot of questions about what their off-season training programs are going to entail. However, for other teams, there is a lot that we actually will be able to learn. And so I'm going to take you through what I think some of the most interesting stories are in OTAs. And, you know, you can watch out for them over the summer. Keep tabs on some of these stories, how they develop, starting off with the Las Vegas Raiders. And, you know, the most glaring thing is Fernando Mendoza. What is he going to look like in his first NFL training camp? Is he going to, you know, get a quick grasp of the playbook? Is he going to struggle to read defenses? How is he going to play at game speed? Those are all things that Coach Kubiak and the Raiders are going to be looking for in Mendoza during OTAs. And, you know, it's not the most dependable system necessarily, because a lot of it is 7-on-7. A lot of it is minimal contact. A lot of it is slowed down or repeated. It's not exactly a real-time simulated scenario. But Mendoza still gets a chance to get his feet wet. He gets some chemistry with his teammates, understanding how to hand the ball off to Genty, which angles he likes it at, the speed at which he's got to throw, and the timing with each of his receivers. Who does he like to throw to? Who are his favorite targets? What route concepts does he like the best? These are all little things. It feels like detailed, silly minutia, but this is all very important for building a quarterback and developing a player. And I think Fernando Mendoza is going to have a very good camp. I think that he is going to be the kind of player who is, you know, the first one at the facility, the last one to leave. I know it's a cliche, but that's what we've seen from Mendoza his entire life. We know he's probably going to outwork everybody else. He's going to spend an overwhelming amount of time in the film room with his coaches and with Kirk Cousins to, you know, get off to as quick of a start as he can. I've said it before. I really do think the Kirk Cousins signing in Vegas was such a good idea, because personality-wise, the two of them fit so well together. Game style-wise, they're pretty similar as well. They're both pocket passers. Neither of them have the strongest arm, but they're both accurate and try to read defenses, so Kirk can help him a lot with that. And a lot of the things that you want your rookie quarterback learning are traits that a game manager like Kirk Cousins would have. Getting in and out of the huddle, understanding the play calls, repeating information to the teammates, shifting protections at the line of scrimmage. Those are all small-scale things that Cousins is really going to help Mendoza improve on, and OTAs is the first chance to do it. Next, heading over to the Ravens. This one's interesting because of the new culture and the identity that they're trying to set. The Ravens have been the same team for a while, led by John Harbaugh, led by a quick and fast defense, and once Lamar Jackson came in, led by a run-dominant and explosive offense. Now, it was a great run for them. They got close to the Super Bowl a bunch of times, but were never able to get over the top. And now they fired Harbaugh, they hired Jesse Minter, and it is a new outlook here for this Baltimore Ravens team. The reports from the first day of OTAs were that practice was loud, that the defense looked ready, and that the team was fired up. And those are all really encouraging things, I think, for Baltimore, because this is a team that has struggled with injuries. It felt like their roster was a bit depleted last season in a few key areas, and so they bring in Jesse Minter to try to get more out of some of the defensive guys that weren't living up to their potential, and it seems like he may be doing his job. This Ravens defense is going to be a bit more physical. They're going to be a little more explosive, and if that all comes together, then turning around and having Lamar Jackson set the pace of play on offense creates what I think could be a really good team in Baltimore. I think the Ravens could be really competitive once again. Despite all their issues and injuries last year, they still almost finished 500. And I think that the Ravens are absolutely going to be contenders in the AFC once again. If you get a full season of healthy Lamar, if you can find, you know, just one more playmaker to pair with him, then I think this team could be really dangerous. Also, apparently the offensive line starting to look a little improved too. The center is making progress, so things to watch out for. The Kansas City Chiefs. The biggest question, of course, is Patrick Mahomes. A lot of the reports were that he would be ready to go by OTAs, which is just truly absurd when you think about it. He tore his ACL in mid-December. This is supposed to be a 9 to 12 month injury, maybe more than that. And it's been, what, 6 months? And he's already back on the football field. Granted, it's not like he's out there, you know, taking hits and playing at game speed, but he's jogging, he's been running for a while, he's doing workouts, he's throwing. Those are all crucial things and details and signs that he may be ready as early as week one. A lot of people were doubting if they would be able to, you know, have Mahomes back or if they would have to roll with Justin Fields. And it's still going to be a question mark because you don't want to take any risks with a guy like Mahomes. But the fact that he may be returning this early is truly shocking and truly impressive. Not to mention, they officially are starting two new offensive tackles this season compared to last year. So that's going to create a bit of a new look for the Chiefs. We know they struggled with their offensive line. They struggled with the depth on their offensive line greatly. And so adding these new pieces, shuffling things around, will hopefully be a little more effective. The Chiefs are very much so still here. And if you get Mahomes back and healthy, and if he looks like himself in week one, there's no reason to believe that they're not just going to be the same old Chiefs. They struggled last year. They're allowed a down year after making three straight Super Bowls. I believe Kansas City is going to be right back in the mix this upcoming season. Next, the Arizona Cardinals. This is one of the most entertaining, I think, OTA minicamp sagas that you could follow because it's just such a, you know, a bit of a mess. It's just so confusing that it makes it entertaining. It's like a hot mess, you know. First of all, you've got Jeremiah Love, who is one of the most talented rookies that we've ever seen, one of the best running back prospects of the last decade. He's coming in, and how they use him is going to be heavily studied because he is one of the best runners, but he's also an incredibly talented receiver. And so people were like, all right, Arizona, first day of minicamp, first day of OTAs, I mean, how are we going to see Jeremiah Love used? Are you going to put him in the backfield? Are you going to split him out wide? Are you going to bring him in motion? How are you going to maximize his talent? Well, today he's practicing returning kicks. Kicks! They've got Jeremiah Love on the special teams. And look, if you want to, you know, incorporate him there, later on, fine. If you think he's a talented returner, okay. Why is this the first thing you're working on? Jeremiah Love is one of the most powerful and quick runners in the NFL already. And you're not putting him behind the offensive line. You're not spending time teaching him different run concepts, how to follow blocking schemes and patterns, how to recognize linebackers and defenses. No, you're returning kicks. So I don't really understand what the heck is happening in Arizona. I have no idea what this team is going to look like next year, but they got to get their act together. Jacoby Brissett, by the way, their starting quarterback. The fact that the team is starting Jacoby Brissett as their quarterback in 2026 still tells you all you need to know about where this franchise is at. He's not even there. So he may be dealing with a personal issue, but whatever it is, Arizona is off to a slow start for a franchise that needed maybe a quicker start than anyone. It's clear that this team is already focused on the 2028 season and the 2027 draft, and I fully expect this team to be in the mix to draft a guy like Arch Manning or one of these other star quarterbacks come next year. All right, last team to check in on OTAs is the Tennessee Titans. This is, I think, a fascinating dynamic in Tennessee because of the way that the coaching staff is set up. The Titans hired Robert Saleh as the defensive coordinator. And what we know about Saleh's career is he is a remarkably talented defensive coach. He can get top-end defensive performances out of various groups of talent. Doesn't have to be the best players. Doesn't have to be the most impressive roster. Saleh's a great coach. As a head coach, he struggled a bit. With the Jets, he always had the great defenses, but the offense never really came together. So what does Saleh do now that he gets another opportunity in Tennessee? He goes out and hires Brian Daboll, who has had the exact opposite experience. First of all, great offensive coach. Got the most out of a lot of underwhelming offensive talent in Buffalo and throughout his career. Then he goes to New York as a head coach. A lot of promise on offense, some interesting, you know, play calling decisions. Couldn't manage it as a head coach. The defense was a disaster. Couldn't do the leadership stuff. So these two gentlemen are joining forces. And I think it'll be real fun to see just how they divvy up the coaching work. Because I really do think Saleh is just going to handle all of the defense. Daboll is just going to handle all of the offense. And we'll see how the two work together. And I think that's just such a fun dynamic because usually there's one guy overseeing everything and there's more responsibility and stuff. But these are two players, or two coaches, excuse me, who have experience coaching entire rosters and have thrived in the instances where they focused on one side of the field. So I think that this is going to be a fun back and forth. All right. That was our look into OTAs. We've got about 15 minutes left here in the first hour. We are going to take one short break, and when we come back, we are grabbing our blankets, starting a fire, and heading to Giants Corner for the last time. With you right back after this.
Did you know that the University of Maryland is one of the 50 fittest colleges in America? Our state-of-the-art Epley Recreation Center, School of Public Health, Ritchie Coliseum, and Cole Fieldhouse have a number of resources that help keep Terps happy, active, and healthy. Join the daily group fitness workouts, request a personal trainer, or own your independence and build your own training plan. Exercise can improve muscle strength and boost your endurance and confidence. Feel better and live longer.
Speech problems. Who's got them? If you're worried about that class presentation, come on down to the Oral Communication Center, or OCC for short. We offer support for students who need help with their communication and public speaking skills. We're based in the Skinner Building in room 2117 from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. But if you need a little help in the afternoon, we're in McKeldin Library room 2111 after 4 p.m. Go to umd.mywconline.net to schedule an appointment, but Walk-ins are always welcome. See you there.
Ride my bike with no handlebars. No handlebars.
Sign up for the weekly bike rides every Tuesday around College Park. Don't have a bike? Just rent it from the campus bike shop. Spending time outdoors has great benefits. It raises your vitamin D levels, it improves concentration and focus, helps you recover from injury and stress, and it may even mean more smiles throughout the day. To get more information, log on to crs.umd/Maryland Adventure Program. Hashtag stay active.
I can tell you about Leif Erickson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American.
Start a startup with other startups at Startup Shell. Get started at startupshell.org.
All right, welcome back in. We've got about 10 minutes here in the first hour of our show, and we have got a lot to talk about. So, we are moving to the last ever edition of a segment that I call Giants Corner. Let's get cozy, grab a blanket, make a hot cocoa, or, you know, add some extra marshmallows in there for this time, and let's talk about the team that is much more comfortable and inviting now than they ever used to be, and that is the New York Football Giants. Because the vibe shift is truly remarkable. Going from, you know, chaos and uncertainty in the coaching staff, in the quarterback position, on the offensive line, everything, to now being this nice, enjoyable, and comfortable place for NFL fans, I think is something that is really beautiful. And as a Giants fan, it's exciting to see the new direction that this team is moving in. And all of this was represented from John Harbaugh in the town hall that he gave the other night with some of the other members of the Giants front office. And Harbaugh reassured us of a lot of things. First of all, that this is a new team and a new franchise, and that we are adapting a different vision than we've had in the past. He mentioned he doesn't care what's happened in the past few years. It's not important to him where this team has been recently. He wants to take it to another level and view this as a rebuilding project and a new group. So a couple things that he pointed out, other than the fact that we're moving on from this era of disaster in New York Giants history, is we are establishing this physical and exciting identity. The Giants made a lot of signings and offseason moves that pointed to this exact thing. First of all, drafting Arvil Reese, Francis Maui Goa, Colton Hood are all strong physical players who are going to get in your face and play tough. Signing guys like Patrick Ricard, the fullback, some of the other offensive linemen and receivers that we brought in who are scrappier. This is going to set a tone for this Giants team. Tremaine Edmonds on the defensive side, another strong physical piece. The Giants believe that you shouldn't get pushed around. You should push your opponents around. And the Giants have been pushed around for far too long, and Harbaugh is hoping to come in and change that. He also said that running the ball is important. They asked him about his philosophy on the game. And he said, look, if you can't run the ball, you are essentially at the defense's mercy because they know that you have to pass. They're going to adjust their coverage no matter what. So expect the Giants to be running the ball a lot this season. And I think that that is incredibly exciting. The Giants' run game should be one of the best run games in the NFL next year. Straight up. Greg Roman, for all of the hate that he gets for his lack of offensive creativity, from a run game perspective, he can scheme up one of the best game plans in the NFL. He's very good at that. From a talent perspective, the Giants have Cam Scadaboo and Tyrone Tracy, who are both good players who complement each other perfectly. Scadaboo brings more of the power and the inside running between the tackles. Tracy's a little more quick and dynamic, more of a receiving back. So you've got talent, you've got guys in the backfield, and you've got a good scheme for them. Not to mention Patrick Ricard, big bruising fullback, going to lead the way on a lot of these inside runs. CeCe Maui Goa Andrew Thomas and Jermaine Illuminor, great run-blocking offensive linemen who are going to make an impact right away. And on top of all of that, Jackson Dart can run as well. The read options, the scrambling outside the pocket. This Giants run game should be incredibly effective. And if that is working, it's going to open up everything else for the pass game. It's going to allow the Giants to control more of the tempo in the game, manage possession time, not go give up quick drives. So that is my expectation for this Giants culture and offense this upcoming season. Defensively, things are going to be a little tougher for them, and this is still where the Giants clearly have issues. The front seven I expect to be solid. I think the Giants are going to try to commit to stopping the run. Tremaine Edmonds, Arville Reese, both very good run defenders, not to mention the plethora of guys along the defensive line, Abdul Carter, Brian Burns, Kayvon Thibodeau, Darius Alexander, etc., creates a very dynamic and talented front seven for New York. Now, the back end and in the secondary is where things start to fall apart a bit. They drafted Colton Hood, who is a very solid player. Drew Phillips has shown potential as a corner. But for the most part, this Giants secondary would get torn to pieces by any reliable pass game. And I think it'll be... I'm curious to see how the Giants adjust for this. What they do on the defensive side of the football to prevent just getting torched every game. Because unless you can get to the quarterback really quickly, it's going to be a bad look. So the Giants have their strengths. They have their weaknesses. Depending on how good of a coach Harbaugh really is, we'll see which ones, you know, show themselves the most. I do think the Giants are going to be good this season. I think that they're going to be in competition to win the NFC East. That's as much because of the step up I think they'll take as the step back everyone else will. I don't believe in the Cowboys defense any more than I do the Giants defense. The Eagles, I've never believed in their culture and infrastructure, especially now that we're all kind of waiting silently for A.J. Brown to be traded, and Washington has too many holes on their roster to really compete. So the Giants are not super far away in this division. I actually think that they are very much so alive in the division this season. Not to mention, I think they'll get one more identity and culture boost when they sign Odell Beckham Jr. on June 1st, which is what a lot of the reports are looking like. They're waiting until the 1st for cap space reasons. But man, if that happens, I would be thrilled. The chance to see Odell put that jersey on one more time, I would love it. All right. One last note here in the first hour of our show is we're going to talk about the Pittsburgh Steelers. Because they have officially came back and signed Aaron Rodgers to a one-year deal. And one would assume he's going to be their starting quarterback for this upcoming season. Why? I have been so tired of the Aaron Rodgers drama and saga for years now. I'm old enough to remember when I came on this show for the very first time. Back in April of 2024, and I said I was tired of the Aaron Rodgers drama. It was right in the middle of, you know, the Jets pondering, is Rodgers going to come back? What's going to happen? Guys, I'm sick of it. He is not a relevant player. Look, he spent the whole offseason pondering, am I coming back? Am I not coming back? Am I coming back? He skipped interviews with the Steelers. He had meetings with different people. He was traveling. I'm tired of the drama, and we're going to get more stories this offseason about Aaron Rodgers clashing with Mike McCarthy over some little thing. Aaron Rodgers having an issue with a teammate. I don't want it. I'm not here for it. The Steelers are officially cooked this upcoming season, in my opinion. Like, I'll talk about the upside because I have an obligation to. He is not the worst player in the NFL. He's reminiscent of probably where Russell Wilson was when he first joined Denver, or I don't know what some of these other comparisons could be, where Daniel Jones is now. He's not a top 10 quarterback. He's not a top 15 quarterback. He's not a quarterback that can win you games on his own. Now, if I thought the Steelers were good enough to win games with the rest of that roster and the defense and the run game, then it's a different story, and maybe Aaron Rodgers in his old age can come in, game manage, and try to get one more ring. But the Steelers need to be tearing it down. They need to be trading their good players for draft picks. They need to be not tanking, but they need to be focusing and prioritizing a rebuild. And signing Aaron Rodgers, hiring Mike McCarthy, retaining all of these guys, isn't going to do any of that. I don't believe in the Steelers' offensive line. I don't believe in their running game. Rodgers is not a good enough quarterback to make the passing game overwhelming enough, which means this offense is going to be ineffective. The defense has too many holes. Look, the Steelers, through the sheer will, it seemed, of Mike Tomlin, managed to get to the playoffs and get to 500 every year. I don't see how that's going to be the case this season. All right, we're going to take one more quick break here to close off the first hour of our show. When we come back at 1, we have got a lot to get into. It's going to be a fun hour here on Winning Time in College Park with you after this.
Speech problems. Who's got them? If you're worried about that class presentation, come on down to the Oral Communication Center, or OCC for short. We offer support for students who need help with their communication and public speaking skills. We're based in the Skinner Building in room 2117 from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. But if you need a little help in the afternoon, we're in McKeldin Library room 2111 after 4 p.m. Go to umd.mywconline.net to schedule an appointment, but walk-ins are always welcome. See you there.
Are those early morning classes starting to feel like a marathon? Did Dodge strike again, towing your car when you least expected it? We get it, and we're here to listen. Whether it's academic stress, relationship issues, or just a bout of loneliness, Lean on Me College Park is here for you. Our supporters are fellow students trained in mental health support to help you through life's ups and downs. You can text our free and anonymous line anytime from 2 p.m. to 2 a.m. 7 days a week at 301-494-8808. You can also follow us at leanonme_CP for updates and resources. Again, our number is 301-494-8808.